Good afternoon, class. I'm reading this from Creekwood, and it's the 14th of December. Tomorrow is going to be our final class in this study of Augustine, and it's fitting that this entire class, and this audio summary as well, is going to be a summary of Augustine's testimony. Book 8 of the 10-book series of Confessions is a detailed recollection of the actual event that happened when he was 32 years old. At that point, he was living in Italy at the base of the Alps in Milan. His teenage son that he had had with his live-in girlfriend was 15 at the time, probably 14. And book 8 begins with the storm that was occurring in Augustine's heart. And I'm going to try to read to you a summary. It's going to be rather long, so buckle up. It's going to start book 8 in paragraph 1.2, and I'm just going to clip the wave tops, so to speak. I may have to rephrase myself because this is all going to be one long audio recording. I saw the church filled with people, some having chosen one way, some the other, but my own secular life, it vexed me. It was a harsh slavery that had become a heavy burden since I was no longer inflamed with hopes of wealth and honors. I had now found the excellent pearl, but to buy it, I would have to sell everything, and I hesitated. I'm going to step out of that paragraph and say that Augustine had come to understand the truth. He had attended church, and just like people in church today, some members of church are not Christian. You know that Pastor Chris tells us this. It's a fact. And Augustine was one of those people. And our prayer should always be for the people that are in church hearing the truth, and they are at war inside their hearts with the old self and the new self, that new birth from being born again, that they would, as Augustine, wrestle with it and finally surrender their hearts. We'll continue in paragraph 5.10. A thwarted will gives rise to lust, and whoever serves lust turns it into something customary. And what is customary is not resisted, but becomes necessity. It was through these links joined together, which is why I call it a chain, that a harsh bondage was holding me fettered. Yet the new will that had begun to rise within me, the will to serve you selflessly, longed to delight in you, God, O soul pleasure, and was not yet capable of overcoming my former will, which had been hardened by age. And so I came to understand through my own experience what I had read, how the flesh lusts against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh. I was standing on both sides, but more on the side of what I approved of in myself than on the side of what I disapproved. What I disapproved of was no longer I, for I was in large measure enduring it unwillingly rather than acting of my own free will. But it was my fault that habit was becoming so combative against me because I had willingly gone to where I did not want to be. I was still conscripted of this world, refusing to serve you as a soldier, and I was afraid of shedding all my burdens as I should have been afraid of shouldering them. See, Augustine is battling inside of himself, and he's saying that he didn't want to give up his sin. I'll continue in paragraph 5.12. In vain I delighted in your law of the inner man, when in my limbs another law was battling against the law of my mind, leading me to be captive under the law of sin that was in my limbs. For the law of sin is the violence of habit, through which even the unwilling mind is drawn in and held, as it deserves to be, since it's willingly acquiesced. Who could then deliver me, wretched as I was, from the body of this death, other than your grace, through Jesus Christ our Lord? Lord, my Savior and Redeemer, I will now recount and avow before you how you delivered me from the shackles of carnal lust by which I was so firmly bound, and how you delivered me from the slavery of worldly affairs. I continued living my daily life, but with increasing anxiety, and every day I longed for you. I kept attending your church whenever I was free from the tasks whose weight was smothering me. Alypius was living with me, unoccupied by legal work after his third term as assessor, and was waiting for someone to whom he could sell his counsel, the way I had sold my art of speaking, to the extent that some can impart such art through teaching. Nebridius, for his part, had consented as an act of friendship to teach as an assistant under Verecundus, to whom we were all very close. On one day, a certain Potentius came to see me and Alypius at our lodgings on some business or other. Nebridius happened to be absent. He was a countryman of ours insofar as he was from Africa and held a high office at Emperor's court. I can't remember what he wanted from us, but we had sat down to talk when he happened to notice a book lying on a gaming table in front of us. Potentius picked it up, opened it, and to his surprise he found that to be of the Apostle Paul, for he had imagined that it would be one of the books in which I was wearing myself out in my profession. He looked at me with a smile, commended me, and expressed surprise as having found this Apostle Paul's book, and only this book at my side. It turned out he was a Christian, and he was devout, bowing before you, our God, in frequent and extended prayer in church. This Potentius told us how one afternoon in Trier, when the emperor was at the circus, Potentius and three companions had gone for a stroll in the gardens by the city walls, where they walked in pairs, one companion walking with him and the other two on their own. And as the two were walking, they came upon an abode in which some of your servants were living, humble in spirit, to whom the kingdom of heaven belonged, and there they found a book that described the life of Saint Anthony. One of the two men began to read it, and filled with admiration and excitement, as he began to read, he began to consider taking up such a life, giving up his worldly post in order to serve you. The two men were imperial administrators, and the man reading the book was suddenly filled with holy love and somber shame. In anger at himself, he looked at his friend and he said, "Tell me, I beg of you, what will we achieve with all of our work? What are we seeking? What's the reason for our service? Can we hope for anything more in the imperial court than to be a friend to the emperor? And isn't that a dangerous place to be, filled with peril? And then there are even more perils we'll have to endure in order to reach even greater perils. And when we should finally reach it, yet if we want to be a friend of God himself, I can be a friend to him right away." He spoke these words in anguish, with the birth pangs of a new life. He looked back down at the page and read on and was changed deep inside, where only you, God, can see. In this recollection, Augustine is telling us of a conversation that he had from a visitor from the imperial court named Potentius, of a friend of his that was converted. This was the story that Potentius told, but while he was speaking, you, Lord, made me turn and look at myself, coaxing me out from behind my own back to where I had retreated, unwilling to look at myself. Many years of my life had passed since my 19th year, some 12 years, when I had read Cicero's Horstentius and was stirred to an earnest love of wisdom. But I still deferred renouncing worldly happiness and freeing myself to search for that of which not finding, but the more seeking was preferable to all the treasures and kingdoms of mankind and to the pleasures of the body that were available all around me, which I could have at will. But I had been a wretched young man, most wretched at the very beginning of my youth, when I prayed to you for chastity, saying, "Grant me chastity, only not yet." For I feared lest you might hear me too soon, and too soon heal me of the disease of lust, which I preferred to satisfy rather than to have it extinguished. Man, that's a very truthful statement. That's awesome. Continuing on 7.18. This was gnawing within me, and I felt confounded with horrible shame all the while Potentius was speaking. Having completed his story and the business he had come for, he went on his way, and I was left to myself. What things I now set against myself in my mind! With what scourges of judgment did I lash at my soul, so that it would follow me as I walked after you! But my soul drew back and refused, though it offered no excuse. All arguments were now exhausted and refuted, and there remained only a silent trepidation, and my soul feared, as it feared death, being held back from the very flow of habit through which it was wasting away in death. In this great struggle, of my inner self that I had stirred up powerfully against my soul in the chamber of my heart. Troubled in mind and countenance, I turned to Olympus, and I exclaimed, "What is wrong with us? What is the meaning of all this? Didn't you hear Pontius' words? Those humble people with no learning have arisen and stormed heaven, while we, with all of our learning, but without a heart, have wallowed down below in flesh and blood. Should we be ashamed to follow these people because they've gone before us? Should we not rather be ashamed that we're not following them?" That is what I more or less said to Olympus, and in my fervor I tore away from him while he stared after me in silence and astonishment. I had sounded very strange, and my forehead and cheeks, eyes and color, and the tone of my voice expressed more about my state of mind than the words that I was actually uttering. Now he goes to a garden, and Olympus follows him. This was how ill and tormented I was, accusing myself more bitterly than ever, twisting and retching to break free from my chains that were easing, but were still holding me fast. And you, Lord, penetrated my hidden depths with severe mercy, redoubling the lashes of fear and shame lest I should succumb and not break free of those last frail fetters that remained, allowing them to grow strong once more and bind me all the tighter. And I said to myself deep inside, "Act now. This is the time to act. Act now." In my words, I was already resolved. I almost acted, but I didn't. However, I did not fall back into my former state, but kept close and recovered my breath. I tried once more and came even closer and closer. I could almost touch it. I could almost take hold of it, yet I couldn't reach it, ever touching it, but I couldn't take hold of it, hesitating to die to this death and to live for life. Greater was the sway of the evil to which I was accustomed than the goodness to which I was unaccustomed. And the more the moment neared in which I was about to become another man, the more I was struck by horror. Yet horror did not strike a decisive blow, nor did it turn me away, but it held me suspended. I was being held in check by vain trifles and trifling vanities, my long-standing paramours tearing at my garments of flesh and whispering, "Will you send us away? From that moment on, we shall never be again with you. From that moment on, you will never be again allowed to think of this and that." And what did they mean by this and that? What were they suggesting, my God? Let your mercy repulse it from your servant's soul. What filth they were proposing. What infamy. Now, I less than half heard them, and they did not dare come out to contradict me openly in my mind, but muttered as if behind my back, plucking at me almost furtively, so I would turn and look. But they managed to hold me back and delay me from tearing myself away and shaking myself free from them and making me leap to where I was being summoned, while the force of my habits called out to me, "Do you think you can bear being without me?" This dispute within my heart was merely myself battling myself. And Olympus, who was at my side in the garden, waited in silence for the end of my unusual agitation. From hidden depths, a profound introspection had gathered together and amassed all my misery before my heart's eye. And now a violent tempest arose within me, bringing a mighty shower of tears, and I got up and I hastened away from Olympus so that my storm could gush forth with all its sounds and voices. Solitude seemed to me more fit for weeping, and I moved as far away from Olympus so that his presence wouldn't burden me. That was the state I was in, and Olympus sensed it, for as I got up, I think I said something in which my voice was choked with tears. And confounded, Olympus remained where we had sat. I collapsed beneath a fig tree, some distance away, I don't remember how, and let my tears flow, streams pouring from my eyes, an acceptable sacrifice to you. And I said many things to you, not in these exact words, but to this purpose. "But you, O Lord, for how long, Lord, will you be angry forever? Remember not our former iniquities." For I felt that these iniquities were holding me in their grip. I uttered these wretched words, how long, ever tomorrow and tomorrow? Why not right away? Why can't my basement come to an end this instant? I was speaking and weeping in the most bitter contrition of my heart when I suddenly heard from a nearby house a voice, that of a boy or a girl, I can't remember, repeating in a sing-song, "Pick up and read, pick up and read." In that instance, my countenance changed, and I began to wonder intently whether this could be some kind of game in which the children sang such words, but I couldn't remember there being such a game when I was a child. I checked my torrent of tears and I rose, concluding that these words were clearly a divine command that I open the book and read the first line I found in the Bible. I had heard how St. Anthony had come upon a reading of the gospel, and he understood the words as being an admonition, as if they were being spoken directly to him. Go, sell everything you have and give it to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, and come, follow me. So, with these divine words, he was immediately converted to you. Well, I hastened back to the place where Olympus was sitting, for it was there that I had laid down the volume of the Apostle Paul when I had risen and left. I came back, I seized it, I opened it, and in silence I read the first verse which my eyes fell upon. Not in revelry or drunkenness, not in lewdness or lust, not in strife or envy, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ, and make not provision for the flesh. Well, I neither wished nor needed to read further. Instantly, at the end of these lines, it was as if a light of serenity were pouring into my heart and all the darkness of uncertainty dispersed. I shut the book, putting my finger or some other mark between the pages, and with a calm countenance, I told Olympus what had happened. But he also appraised me of the change within him, of which I had not been aware. He asked to see what verse I had read. I showed it to him, and he read it, and read further than I had. I did not know what verse had followed. What followed was, "Receive one who is weak in the faith." And Olympus told me that he was applying this to himself. This admonition gave him strength in his pious resolution and purpose, which truly corresponded to his character, in which he had always been very much different from me, for the better. And without turbulent hesitation, he joined me. We go inside to my mother. We tell her. She rejoices. We recount how it had come to pass. She exults, jubilates, and she praises you who are able to do beyond that which we desire or understand. She saw that you had granted her far more for me than she had begged for in her sad and tear-filled laments to you, for you had converted me to you, so that I now sought no ambition of this world and stood firm upon that rule of faith as you had shown me to my mother in that dream so many years before. And you converted her mourning into joy, even more abundantly than she had hoped for, and in a way that was much more precious and pure than she had ever sought. Well, if you've put up with that reading, almost 20 minutes, bless you. And I look forward to seeing y'all tomorrow.